grab your Bibles and open them, whether it's a physical copy that you brought or on your phone, and scroll to 2 Corinthians. We're going to back up our text a little bit. So 2 Corinthians, we're going to start at chapter 3, verse 12. And to make sure you stay awake and pay attention, would you rise, please, and hear the word of the Lord. 2 Corinthians 3, beginning at verse 12. Paul says, "Since then we have such a hope, we act with great boldness, not like Moses, who put a veil over his face to keep the people of Israel from gazing at the end of the glory that was being set aside. But their minds were hardened. Indeed, to this very day, when they hear the reading of the Old Covenant, the same veil is still there, since only in Christ is it set aside. Indeed, to this very day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their minds. But when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. Now, the Lord is spirit, and where the spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And all of us, with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, the Spirit. Therefore, since it is by God's mercy that we are engaged in this ministry, we do not lose heart. We have renounced the shameful things that one hides. We refuse to practice cunning or to falsify God's word. But by the open statement of the truth, we commend ourselves to the conscience of everyone in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For we do not proclaim ourselves. We proclaim Jesus Christ as Lord and ourselves as slaves for Jesus' sake. For it is God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." This is the word of the Lord. Please have a seat. On Friday, I was out seeing a movie with my friend Peter, who's the pastor at New Life Fellowship. And we are good friends, and we are talking after the credits were rolling about what we're speaking on this Sunday. And when I told him the text I was speaking on, his response was, "The reason there are Calvinists is like me is because of texts like that." And that's not really a joke, because I don't really expect you to understand what Calvinists believe in, Arminians, and so on. But let me explain this just a little bit, because it bears on our passage today. One of the debates between Calvinists and Arminians is the debate over who chooses God. Is it the individual who chooses God and therefore exercises free will? Or as the Calvinists would say, it's God who chooses who will be saved, and free will doesn't play into that. That's the essential debate between the two of them, okay? And this is not an academic issue. If you think about it, this has a very practical issue for how you live every single day of your life as you rub shoulders with non-Christians. Right? If you believe that God chooses who will be saved and who will not be, then it's not really up to you to share your faith. Or at least if it is, it doesn't make a difference one way or another to that person's salvation, right? Because they don't have a choice in it. It's up to God. So Calvinists would still say we should share our faith, but they would ultimately say that it doesn't depend on our sharing, whether or not one chooses God. You know, and this is not a debate between Baptists versus CRC. There are Calvinists and Arminians in Baptist circles both. Now, our CRC brothers and sisters do tend to lean very much toward the Calvinist side of things, but, you know, vive la difference, right? And we have good conversations over it. It's fun. So the reason is that I bring that up is because this bears on our passage where Paul starts talking about the fact that we're sharing our faith and we're out there. And there are reasons why it's actually important that we share our faith. I am not quite as sure as my friend Peter that this passage is as clear as he thinks it is, but that's okay. We have good conversation. So let me say, first of all, if you find some of this confusing, A, I do too, and I probably won't clarify it a whole lot, but you can feel free to bring it up when we have Q&A and say, you are still obscure here. Okay? So there will be time for that. Next, Paul is responding to people who are accusing him of being obscure. The reason, Paul, that more people aren't responding to the gospel is because you're intentionally vague, or you're hiding it, or you're being obscure. And Paul here is saying, actually, no, I'm not. There are other reasons why people aren't responding to the gospel the way that you have and the way that you expect them to. Now, what's the gospel? We talked about it last week, so I'm going to refer you back to that. You can listen online. Let me just summarize and say the gospel is the message that says that Jesus is Lord of everything, and therefore everything must change. And last week we shared the story about how that actually touches down in individuals' lives, and it changes the life of a slave. It changes the life of a slave, that slave owner, and it eventually, the gospel will change the very life of the culture and their attitude towards slavery. The gospel isn't simply that someone accepts the message that Jesus forgives their sins. The gospel is the message that Jesus is Lord, and therefore everything, including your sinful life, must change. The gospel is way bigger, way, way bigger. Everything must change. So Paul, why are you then being so obscure, and why aren't more people responding to this amazing good news that Jesus is king and therefore everything changes? And here's his response, our passage. So please have it open in front of you. I'm not going to have anything up here. You're going to need to be looking at your texts. But Paul begins, I had to back us up into a passage we've already covered in order to make our present passage today a little bit more comprehensible. So Paul begins his answer by saying the reason why people don't believe the good news all the time is actually not because of the news itself or even because of the people themselves. It's because there's another power at work. In fact, Ron mentioned it today in our service or in his prayer. So we're going to get there. But he starts with Moses. He starts with Moses and he says the people of this world who don't believe the gospel yet are veiled. There's a veil over their eyes. What does that mean? He's alluding to the story of Moses. When Moses went up to the mountain to meet God, he had this incredible experience with God where they were talking face to face, and it physically changed Moses. When Moses comes down the mountain, his face is shining because he has been looking face to face with God. He's been in God's presence, and it has changed him. And as he comes down the mountain, the people see the face of God on Moses' face. He is reflecting the glory of God now to the presence of the people around him, and their reaction says to Moses, we don't actually want to be this close to God. We don't want to see God like that. And Moses, therefore, because their hearts were hard, Moses puts a veil over his face so that there is a barrier between God's presence on his face and the people out there. That's the veil that Paul is now alluding to here. That's the story that he is evoking. The veil is there because they don't want to see God face to face. They do not want his glory. Their hearts are hardened and they react negatively. That's what Paul is alluding to here. So Paul says the reason that they haven't turned is because their hearts are veiled, and it remains that way. And now he's going to add a new element to it. He's going to say that the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers. Now, when he says the God of this age, he is referring to Satan. He's not saying our God. He's saying the God of this world. It's sort of a gesture at Satan, the accuser, the devil. Okay? The God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers. So picture some unbelievers you care about right now. Because I've got some in mind. And you've got to admit in your interactions with them that there is actually more going on than simply the truth is out there and they haven't yet got it. There's more involved. There are spiritual powers at work here. And we need to be aware of them. C.S. Lewis, in the preface to the Screwtape Letters, once warned people, saying, there are two equal and opposite errors which our race falls into about the devils. Two equal and opposite errors. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other error is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. Paul is going to avoid both of those. He's going to acknowledge that they exist, but at the same time, he's not going to spend too much time worrying about it, but he doesn't want to ignore it either. And so we have to find a middle ground in that. And it does create questions for us, and you can feel free to raise them in Q&A. I may or may not be able to give you more of an answer, but we'll see. But Paul would have his readers and hearers admit that there's simply more to the equation when it comes to our friends and our dearly loved family members who do not yet acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord. Now, I have to admit that I don't actually know how this blinding happens. I don't know how the devil is at work, how the God of this world does it. Does he plant thoughts? Does he have that ability? Does he read thoughts or simply body language? You know, your pulse, your breathing, where your eyes go, et cetera, et cetera. Does he put things in our path that distract us and redirect us? Now, I can't say. I don't know. And sometimes we're distracted not simply by bad things, but by good things that aren't the best for us right now, or we obsess about things. So, I don't know. I do not know what level of influence he has. I don't want to give him too much or too little credit. Here's what I do know from our passage. The reason I read a longer portion of the passage is because it veiling the heart and mind is mentioned at least four times in these just few verses. And Paul alternates his language between heart, the heart is veiled, and the mind is veiled. And it's a little unclear. In fact, sometimes it doesn't always come out clearly in your English translation. Some of them do. Some of them will actually say, when it's a heart being veiled, it's the heart. And when it's the mind, it's the mind. But some of them sort of confuse that. But Paul is alternating between the two. Do you know what the distinction is between a heart and mind? When I say heart, biblical language it's not primarily about emotions. When the Bible talks about emotions, it uses language that's sort of further down in the body. It's sort of guts. It's the belly. It might talk about intestines or kidneys if you get a really wooden translation. But ultimately, it's sort of the emotion. It's like you feel it in your gut. So that's a different word that the Bible uses. It doesn't use heart to talk about it, the emotions. The mind is up here, your emotions in biblical thinking are down here, and the heart sits in the middle. The heart is the place where one ultimately decides between what's going on here, up here, and what's going on down here in the emotions. So that's why it's more of the choosing side of things. Now, it does include emotions, but it's not primarily referring to emotions in the same way that we Western people sort of think of things, okay? So Paul is getting at both, though. Sometimes he's talking about a mind being veiled. Sometimes he's talking about a heart being veiled, which would then include emotions, but it's more primarily to do with choosing. But it's both. So Paul is essentially talking about the fact that when people are veiled, when people are blinded to the truth of the gospel, it's not simply a head thing. And it's not simply an emotion thing. And it has more to do with choosing. And it has more to do with navigating the strange way that the human person as a whole is made up. It's more to it than just truth. And you need to hear that, my friends. Because I made the mistake when I was about 20, 21 years old of getting into a really strong debate with a friend. And he was just having fun poking. And I thought, let's engage this a little more because ultimately I just want him to get to know the truth. And if I can present the truth as it is, he will automatically shift. And that was really, really painful. And it didn't end well. Because there's more to this, my friends, than simply presenting people with truth. There's more going on. We need to present truth. Feel free to do that. But don't simply expect that when you do that, everything will just be sweetness and light, and it all will have resolved. Unfortunately, it doesn't work out that way all the time. It might, but it won't be simply because you've presented the truth. So, heart and mind. This isn't just about knowledge. It's a little bit more about perception and interpretation. You know when two people experience or look at the same thing and they have different takeaways from it? You remember a number of weeks back, I told you a story about the fact that there was one time where I was riding the bus down in Hamilton, sweaty, hot, humid summer, and the place, the bus just absolutely reeked, and it had a spicy element to it. And ever since, every time that I taste or smell cumin, that's where my mind goes, right away to this horrible Hamilton bus experience. I despise cumin, absolutely despise. Some of you guys love it, and we have equal but opposite experiences to the same thing, right? This has to do a little bit more with interpretation, perception, interpretation, than it simply has to do with cumin as a spice. It has a little bit more to do with the fact that we are going to, people are going to view the same Jesus differently, and it's not because they have the facts wrong. It's because there's a heart interpretive perception issue going on. Okay? What else do I know? Maybe just a side warning. You can't scapegoat the devil at the same time. So please don't say the devil made me do it. Paul would not say that either. We need to be honest and say that we also tempt ourselves, we harden ourselves, we blind ourselves too. So, and if this is a heart issue, it's also ultimately about choice. And Paul will not say that these people have no choice in the matter. People are choosers. Ultimately, it's about influence, not control. And it's not determinative. People change. People might currently be veiled, but they may not always be. And we need to hear that. We need to hear that there is hope. Just because your friends and family do not currently know Jesus and are currently experiencing a spiritual blindness and a veil over their eyes doesn't mean that they always will. And it doesn't mean that the next time that you share honestly about the fact that you follow Jesus and he's made a change in your life, it doesn't mean that that might not be the very moment where that veil is lifted and someone turns and they experience Jesus the way you have. You don't know. This is not determinative, but it's a factor. And we need to keep that factor in mind. Now, here's the rub in the Calvinist versus Arminian debate. When one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. You need to see that. Chapter 3, verse 16. When a person turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. That's Paul saying that. If you are blind or veiled, here's my question. If you're blind or veiled, then how do you see to turn to the Lord? This is a mystery for me that I don't get. I can't answer this. And then when the person turns and the veil is lifted, is that sequential, as in the person turns first and then the veil is lifted? Or does it happen simultaneously? As the person turns to the Lord, the veil is lifted. This is the whole Calvinist-Arminian debate that I don't know. I'm not sure. If you're blind and you're hard-hearted, because we taught blindness is a result of being hard-hearted, why would you turn? What motivates that turn? I don't know. I'd like to just raise these questions because there's a great deal of mystery in this for me, whether you're Calvinist or an Arminian. The veil is removed, and who removes it? Text doesn't say. Is it by God? Is it by the person? Is it both? If it's both, who does the heavy lifting? Is it equal? I can't say. These are mysteries. Paul doesn't say any of that. So I simply create a problem I cannot solve in order to admit the fact that my Calvinist friend also has a problem that he probably cannot solve. Okay? And really, that's not what Paul wants us to know. So I'd like to acknowledge it, but then move on. What he wants us to know is there are outside spiritual influences, that there is blindness, and it's not because of a lack of information, that it's not determinative because it's the person who does the turning. Okay? We are still active agents who choose. And lastly, what Paul would want us to know is that God intervenes. And he intervenes with light. So look at chapter 4, verse 6. For it is the God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. You know, we use the term light bulb moment. That's the way that light is being used here. It's a metaphor for knowledge, a realization. Suddenly the lights went on, and things changed. So light here sort of represents truth or knowledge, and it's strange. It's almost like I've now been talking out of both sides of my mouth. It's like it's not just information. It's not just knowledge. And then Paul goes on to talk about light as though it is knowledge. I don't know. I could just be humble and admit I don't really understand that. There's some revelation involved here that God makes, and it changes things. So there's been a light bulb moment for people, for us. We've met Jesus. Light bulb moment. God's glory is revealed in Jesus, and that's the light bulb. The fact that Jesus Christ is Lord, and that when we see and look at Jesus, we are looking at the very face of God. When Moses comes down the mountain and his face is shining, people are getting a glimpse into what God is like. And here Paul is now saying, when you look at Jesus, you are getting a glimpse of what God is like. And what is God like? He's like Jesus. And what is Jesus like? Well, when he shows up, he talks about good news. And it's good news for spiritually blind people. And they come. They come in droves to meet Jesus, don't they? Some of them leave. Many of them stay. And I'm really glad that you have stayed. So this stuff is good news. God lights up our hearts. And here the heart word is important. God has shone in our hearts, the totality of the person, not just the head, not just the emotions, but right in the middle, the part of you that chooses, the part of you that has to decide between information and just gut reactions. That is the part where Jesus goes to the very center of the person. God has shone in our hearts the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So, I've been talking for long enough. I've created a whole bunch of problems, and I'm not going to solve any more unless you'd like to raise any more. So is there anything that you would like to ask for? Clarification, or this reminds me of, now I need to talk about, what would you like to talk about? We've got a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Great question, Ben. Ben first says, as he understands it, and I think he's right, the people in Moses' day, as they see Moses coming down the mountain and their reaction to it, the people in Moses' day knew what they were reacting to. They knew that they were reacting to the living God and that he was pretty awesome and terrifying. And their reaction, in their reaction, they then choose that veil. It's their reaction that pushes Moses to do that. So their hard-heartedness provokes that response, right? And so Ben's then saying, and what about today? Is there a certain amount of knowledge that people today would have where they are somewhat aware of a God and continue to choose to remain at a distance, to remain unwilling to engage, to remain unwilling to turn to that God? And if so, what should we be doing about it? That's a fair paraphrase. I think you're right at times. I mean, there's simply some people who probably have not actually encountered any real truth about God. But at the same time, the Bible does sort of then talk about, well, God's revealed himself in other ways. Creation, for example. We are in a room full of people who we call the image of God. So in a sense, every day people are interacting with another image of God, even if they look in the mirror. So there's a certain level of things that we can, those outside of any real knowledge about Christ still have accountability for. Creation, image of God that they interact with in the world around them. So yeah, I think you're onto something when we draw a parallel between the people's reaction to Moses and people today. I don't want to make it a general sweeping observation, but I think you're probably more right than wrong. That'd be my guess. And what do we do about it? I'll come back to that. Thanks. Your question is, as the veil goes up and you are seeing God, is there still a moment where we need to wait for God to continue to reveal himself? Yes. I think absolutely. That would be my guess that you're onto something, and that the initial reaction of lifting the veil and seeing, you know, the light bulb moment. I mean, that's what we're talking about, right? We're talking about the light bulb moment where at some point we recognize we're going one way, but actually, I think this is now the right way, and you start moving in that direction. You haven't grasped the full amount of who God is. You just got a glimpse, and you start moving in that direction, and you see a little bit more, and you continue moving in that direction, and you see a little bit more. So yeah, I think absolutely. We are continually in a position of wanting more of God and waiting for God to reveal more of himself. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Is that where you're going? Mm-hmm. Good question. Thanks for that. Ron. Mm-hmm. Yep. For those of you who couldn't hear, Ron's citing the passage in Revelation 3 where Jesus says, "I stand at the door and knock. And if anyone's going to open the door, then we're going to have some communion together. We're going to get to know one another, and I'm going to come in." And he's saying, you know, I don't know exactly how that fits into the whole Calvinist-Arminian debate, but it seems like Jesus is continually waiting at the door and giving that sort of invitation. How then you relate that to the veil and the turning and the spiritual blindness, I'm not exactly sure. And I just want to be honest about that. But regardless of which camp you find yourself in, you have to admit that our whole scriptures are continually inviting response. That there's nothing passive about our Christian faith. From the beginning to the end, it's continually about God asking for further engagement with us, further response. We don't just get our ticket, hop on board, and wait till we arrive at heaven. There's a whole lot more to this. And in fact, I'm not so sure you've got a ticket if you're that passive. That's just Ben, though. Anyway, thanks for raising those. I'm going to get to my last thing, and then we will continue with our worship. Good questions, everyone. Thanks for being brave and for engaging. We're open about who we are and what we're about. Look at the beginning of chapter 4. Remember I said Paul was responding to charges about being obscure? He responds by saying, if people don't get it, it's not my fault. I've been open. I haven't been hiding anything. Verses 2 and 3. That reminded me of an article I read in Christianity Today where a woman shares her story about her New Year's resolution. The title of the article is called "My New Year's Resolution: To Call Myself a Christian in Public." And this gets back to what Ben was saying. How do we deal with this veil? What's our response to those who do not yet know Jesus? What's our role? How about calling yourself a Christian in public? Here's what she says. "Last January, I made an unusual resolution. On New Year's Day, like many people, I peel off the plastic off a planner and imagine its pages filled with earnest but unlikely ambitions. But last year, instead of changing a daily practice, I set out to change a pattern. I would begin to speak openly about my Christian faith. Doing so would require that I reveal my relationship with Jesus to many people outside of my church community for the first time in my life." She says, "I'm a resident of the Nun Zone," so not Christian Red Deer, "the Nun Zone, the Pacific Northwest. It was given that title nearly two decades ago thanks to a high percentage of residents that claim no affiliation with religion whatsoever. In a 2017 Gallup poll of Washington State, 47% of American adults identified as not religious. Seattle, in particular, is one of many American cities where the cultural narrative says Christians are an anomaly at best and anti-intellectual at worst." It's the place where she's living. "When I made my New Year's resolution, I'd already been living in Seattle for 15 years, and I knew how to walk the line. If I met a non-Christian, I'd carefully consider when to reveal that I attend church, and more likely than not, I wouldn't mention it at all. When I was in grad school during that time, a friend of mine was shocked to discover my Christian faith through a blog post I had written. And when I did mention my faith, I would do all that I could to let people know I'm a Christian, but I'm not that kind of Christian, whatever the stereotype of evangelicals was. I was the sort of believer that you could invite to your party." Over time, the strategy of withholding my relationship with Jesus began to backfire, and I started to wither inside. After all, it takes time and energy to present different sides of yourself to different people. No one can be their own PR manager forever. I was swimming in a murky and lukewarm waters with both my online and my real lives, and I'd become disingenuous and detached. The vibrancy of my faith was suffering. After decades of playing it cool, in the hopes that I'd pass some imaginary litmus test with my agnostic and spiritual but not religious friends, let me tell you, it only gets weirder to talk about your faith the longer you wait. I was well aware of the risks of opening up. I knew what it looked like when conversations with non-Christian friends went south, because it had happened to me several times over the years. I remember once sitting outside a cafe, and I told a friend about my faith life and my church attendance, and the heavy weight of silence after I spoke was palpable. We finished our coffee, shuffled through a few more minutes of awkward conversation, and then busted the table. I never heard from him again. A similar scenario played out with an acquaintance I met in a writing class. Over pizza at a restaurant near downtown, I told her about my family of origin, and I talked about my faith and how it impacts my ethics. And instead of inquiring further, the conversation flatlined. We finished a slice, and we parted ways. I spent the next several years playing out in my head and then avoiding similar scenes with other acquaintances. But then the Spirit began to convict me in prayer to move past the shame that I had attached to the gospel. Slowly, God revealed the paradox that I had created. The thing I valued most in life, life with God, was the thing that I'd hidden for fear of judgment. During this past year of practicing a more public witness, here are a few things that I've learned. First, when we withhold our Christian identities, we participate in that cultural narrative that says that we can manage our own messaging, the way that we message ourselves. The need for peer acceptance, in fact, becomes an idol. But the Christian story reminds us that we can't predict the outcomes of our lives, nor can we control how others perceive us or receive us. Second, the people that you think are against you might actually be for you. Although I have been ghosted, you know the term ghosting? It means that people cut off all communication with you, pretend you don't exist. Although I've been ghosted, the opposite has also happened. In the past year, I've had coffee with people from my past who are genuinely curious about my faith experience. These moments have been a gift. I've been able to deeply listen to and better understand the experiences of friends who identify as spiritual but not religious. Conversely, I've also been given the space to speak candidly about Jesus. Finally, I've relearned what I already knew but kept forgetting. I don't sit at the center of this story. God does. As Christians, we believe that our lives are hidden with God and held by Him, and that's immensely liberating. By contrast, it's tiring to exert anxious energy skirting around that reality. In the Sermon on the Mount, we're counseled not to become like salt that loses its saltiness, or a lamp hidden under a bowl. Maybe in recent years, we've had the wrong idea of what it means to be salt. Instead of an in-your-face bumper sticker or a politically charged Facebook post, perhaps we're called to a much simpler practice, being present and transparent with our neighbors. Instead of speaking about our faith ironically or with a carefully chosen filter, let's speak with transparency and boldness. Let's speak with confidence about how God's goodness changes us and changes our communities. What are we going to do? What does that mean for you? I think it means that we start sharing our faith in simple ways, by being the Christian 7 days a week. when you have people over for dinner, what if you continue praying before the meal, even if they don't believe in God? When you have that conversation with your coworkers about what you're going to do or what you did do on the weekend, perhaps you could in fact include the experience of coming here and why you came here and being just open about it, not in your face, but just, this is part of my life, and see if that gets you an invitation. Paul here has been sharing in our passage that we have been open with everyone, and when we're open with everyone, some of them change. That's the hope of the gospel. Some of them are going to meet Jesus because they meet him in you. So be a Christian. Openly.